From Port Allegheny to Huntington, Sarver to Shamokin, this is Lincoln Radio Journal. On this edition, the primary election season now shifts into high gear, and Pennsylvania once again is a key battleground state. David Taylor, Rebecca Euler, and Stephen Bloom are here for a Capitol Watch discussion. And rising costs at the pump have prompted calls to temporarily suspend gas taxes. I'll have a town hall commentary on why that fails to address the real reason for the price hikes. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to Lincoln Radio Journal. We'll get to our Capitol Watch crew in just a couple of minutes, but first we have news headlines from patownhall.com. For the first time since 1958, there is no incumbent running for either governor or U.S. senator from Pennsylvania. Governor Tom Wolf is term limited, and Senator Pat Toomey is retiring. A large field of candidates has emerged for both offices, and most of them made it official this past week as the filing deadline to appear on the May 17th ballot passed. The lone exception to the stampede of candidates is the Democratic nomination for governor, where Attorney General Josh Shapiro will be the only name on the ballot. But on the Republican side, 10 candidates filed to run. Voters in both parties will have large fields of candidates from which to select, as 5 Democrats and 7 Republicans are seeking nomination for the U.S. Senate. Voters statewide also will be nominating candidates for lieutenant governor. And a total of 56 candidates in various districts have filed for Pennsylvania's 17 seats in the U.S. House of Representatives. If you are still trying to catch up from losing that 1 hour of sleep last Sunday, you will be pleased to know the United States Senate has passed a bill that would make daylight savings time permanent across the country, eliminating the semi-annual changing of clocks. The measure passed with strong bipartisan support. It is headed to the House of Representatives for concurrence. Unemployment compensation fraud is a major problem confronting the Pennsylvania Department of Labor and Industry, and fraud became significantly worse as the federal government rolled out increased and extended benefits during the COVID-19 pandemic. During hearings last week before the Senate Appropriations Committee, Labor and Industry Secretary Jennifer Barrier reported much of the backlog in processing claims has been cleared, but ongoing staffing shortages and difficulty in retaining employees has hampered the fight against fraud. Read about all things Pennsylvania at patownhall.com. As mentioned, the fields are now set for the May primary to select candidates who will go head-to-head in November for the state's biggest offices. Here to sort through all of this is our Capitol Watch crew. David Taylor from the Pennsylvania Manufacturers Association is joined by Rebecca Euler from the Pennsylvania Motor Truck Association and by Stephen Bloom from the Commonwealth Foundation. David?
And welcome once again to Capitol Watch, where we keep an eye on what's happening under the Capitol Dome in Harrisburg for you. I'm your host, David Taylor, President and CEO of the Pennsylvania Manufacturers Association. With me in the studio, your Capitol Watch All-Stars, Rebecca Euler, President and CEO of the Pennsylvania Motor Truck Association. Rebecca, great to be with you.
Great to be back again, David. Thank you.
And Steve Bloom, Vice President at Pennsylvania's foremost free market think tank, the Commonwealth Foundation. Steve, great to see you.
Wonderful to be here, David.
Well, we've got a beautiful spring-like day here in Harrisburg, and we're all excited. We've got new legislative maps.
This is a redistricting year in Pennsylvania, of course, across the country, because it's the election immediately following the decennial census. Every 10 years, the U.S. Constitution requires that we figure out how many people live in each state.
An actual enumeration.
An enumeration. And then we have to redesign the map so that each person gets one vote and that it's proportioned in accordance with population. So that has been happening over the last 6 months or so in Pennsylvania. The maps have finally just been settled. The maps for the federal congressional candidates had been settled several weeks ago, but just recently the court has finally approved the Legislative Reapportionment Commission map for the Pennsylvania General Assembly seats, the Pennsylvania House and the Pennsylvania Senate. So now candidates are able to move forward and begin their campaigns for these elections that are coming up, again, May 17th for the primaries, and then in the fall of November for the general election. This is a unique year in Pennsylvania because we have so many open seats in very impactful positions. The governor of Pennsylvania will be chosen in an open seat race. Governor Tom Wolf is termed out, so there'll be a new Democratic candidate and a new Republican candidate and possibly some third-party candidates vying for governor. And U.S. Senate, our U.S. Senator, Pat Toomey, has decided not to seek another term. So the U.S. Senate seat is open. And again, same thing, a number of Democrats and a number of Republicans vying for those seats. All the seats in the General Assembly on the House side and all the U.S. congressional seats in the House of Representatives are up for reelection.
Mm-hmm.
And so you have a massive number of campaigns about to unfold here in Pennsylvania, some of which already are.
And half of the Pennsylvania State Senate.
Half of the State Senate. And so it's just everything is in play. And you are seeing in Pennsylvania this year, if you talk to or listen to any of the national commentators, folks who study elections, they are saying Pennsylvania is the hot spot. It is the spot in which the most money will be spent. And that's because of our critical positioning. The U.S. Senator we elect could determine the balance of power between Republicans and Democrats in the U.S. Senate.
You know, and the crazy thing is, too, I think a lot of people don't realize how much has to happen between now and the election. You said there are 2 months, which is a really compressed time frame because all those candidates have to get out and circulate petitions because every office requires a certain number of signatures on a petition, and some of the offices actually require them be collected in multiple counties. It's a huge effort to get those signatures on the petitions. And then you have things like military and overseas ballots that have to go out way ahead of time. So the ballots actually have to be determined, put together, and the counties have to get them out weeks and weeks ahead of time. And then, of course, voter registration is happening. We're sending out mail ballots. There are just a ton of things that have to happen in a very, very compressed time period.
And so, this is happening much later than it usually
right.
would because of the wrangling over the composition of the districts via the legislative maps that have gone through court challenges and so on and so forth. So at the end, we're having this super compressed period for candidates to scramble and to get those voter signatures to qualify to appear on the ballot. And in fact, that process is really the first challenge of the campaign organization.
Those running for those statewide offices and the U.S. congressional offices, including U.S. Senator, were able to go ahead and collect their signatures on the nominating petitions they needed to get on the ballot and get those filed. But in the meanwhile, the members of the General Assembly or possible candidates for General Assembly were deferred by a court order that delayed their process. So they're starting much later than normal, and we don't even know the full results of that yet. If you look at the U.S. Senate seat, the Pat Toomey seat, there are five Democrats that were nominated or
got on the ballot.
Got on the ballot using their nominating petitions, signatures they gained, seven Republicans. If you look at the governor's race, there's one Democrat and 10 Republicans. If you look at the lieutenant governor's race, there are three Democrats and 9 Republicans running. So you have contested elections yeah. all around except for the
a
Democratic
very crowded
nomination
ballot.
For governor.
Very crowded ballot, except, as you say, for Attorney General Josh Shapiro, who's running unopposed for the Democrat nomination for governor. Something else that really feeds the turmoil is that with the adoption of the new legislative maps, that many members have been drawn out of their districts. They've been drawn into districts with another lawmaker. And also with the changeover that many state representatives, some state senators are just saying, hey, I think I'm going to go ahead and retire. And so that leads to an inordinate number of open seats. So when it comes to policymaking next year in Harrisburg, it's going to be perhaps an almost entirely new cast of characters.
Yeah, you're seeing multiple announcements of retirement every day. There was another one today at least. And every day that goes by, it seems like another lawmaker, especially on the state level, has decided not to seek reelection. And part of that, I think, is also indicative of the very vicious environment that's been out there in the political world
sure.
for these last couple of years, where some of the lawmakers, I think, themselves are becoming just exhausted by the process.
The listeners who have listened to the show for a while know we talk a lot about the business climate in Pennsylvania. So I think we need to look for candidates and hope that these candidates who ultimately win are familiar with the trouble that Pennsylvania has with attracting new businesses, with inspiring, you know, entrepreneurs in Pennsylvania to start businesses. We have an awful business climate in Pennsylvania. So I would hope we get some members who have some business experience,
right,
or worked in the private sector and understand what needs to be done to help Pennsylvania come back. Because I think we all know that Pennsylvania has a lot of potential that we're not able to take advantage of yet.
Absolutely. And that's the thing. Sort of, it's like good news and bad news. The bad news is that we do all these dumb things to ourselves in Harrisburg. But the good news is that means that we have the power to set things right if we choose to. And that's what we need to do, because, Rebecca, you're absolutely correct. The potential that Pennsylvania has from our, you know, our geographic location, access to market, our natural resources, our infrastructure, our institutions of higher learning, our institutions of finance, like, we have amazing assets at work, but we need leaders in Harrisburg who will not be satisfied with being slightly less bad than New York and New Jersey. Like, we need leaders in Harrisburg who are aspirational, who want to, you know, to see Pennsylvania reach the fullness of our potential, and that comes by benchmarking us against high-performing states, which I would argue includes Indiana and North Carolina, which are not too far away.
And part of that is up to us to ask these candidates when we're trying to decide who we're going to vote for. Let's ask them, what plans do you have to make Pennsylvania a better state? What plans do you have for taxes in Pennsylvania? What plans do you have for regulatory reform? Some of the things that we really need to know from these potential leaders. And hopefully we'll get some fresh ideas as some of this turnover happens.
So, Steve, what do you see as being next steps?
Well, as you look at the, in particular, the state legislative races and the race for the new chief executive of the state, the new governor. You know, we in Pennsylvania often end up with divided government. For the last 8 years, we've had a Republican-controlled General Assembly and a Democrat in the governor's office. That has created a lot of stalemates, a lot of pushing back and forth, and in many cases, fortunately, the General Assembly was there to prevent Governor Wolf's desire to massively increase spending, massively increase state taxes, things that would do the opposite of what Rebecca was just talking about, things that would have actually set Pennsylvania back. But at the same time, the Republican policy agenda has sometimes been thwarted because you have a Democrat in the governor's office who was willing to use his veto pen, almost more so than any governor, I think, since 1973, since
Milton Schapp
finished out his term. And so one of the opportunities that's arising now is, even though the new maps are said to be, by some of the folks who've looked at them, to have kind of a bias toward electing Democrats, and both to the U.S. Congress and to the state General Assembly, the national trends don't look good for Democrats.
In the current environment.
In the current environment.
Yeah.
And you're seeing poll after poll showing a generic advantage for Republicans, significant over Democrats. Usually when that happens, it's no guarantee, but usually when we see polling like that, it indicates that Republicans will overperform on the legislative races. We've seen that numerous times historically when numbers look the way they do now. So the maps really won't be the defining factor. It will be the energy of the voters. And when voters especially are frustrated, as they are with the current presidential administration and some of the things happening on the state level as well, it typically bodes well for the party that is ahead on those generic ballots. So I think there's a chance that come next January, when the new governor is inaugurated, it could be a Republican governor working with a Republican-controlled legislature, and it could be a candidate who has committed to running that pro-business, pro-taxpayer agenda that we've been talking about, that will lead Pennsylvania to a place where it can grow and attract residents from other states, attract capital investments from other states, and begin to really compete with the North Carolinas, the Arizonas, the Floridas of the world, who are currently, right now, really hurting Pennsylvania.
You're listening to Capital Watch. I'm your host, David Taylor from Pennsylvania Manufacturers. With me, Rebecca Euler from the Pennsylvania Motor Truck Association and Steve Bloom from Commonwealth Foundation.
Steve, I think you're absolutely right. I think any candidate that can really express that vision for Pennsylvania, the pro-growth, pro-taxpayer agenda, is really going to stand out in this environment right now. And I hope you're right about that, because there is a great opportunity to really latch on to the potential that Pennsylvania has and run on that.
And I would argue that energy is one of the biggest opportunities for Pennsylvania, and especially to hammer at inflation, because inflation is a thief that steals from everyone, and that one of the drivers of inflation is rising energy prices. So if we have a pro-production governor and a pro-production General Assembly that will work to help bring those energy resources to bear to power our economy, lower energy costs, and then that'll ripple effect through the economy, because, of course, you know, as we've said on the program before, that when it comes to production, whether it's agricultural production or industrial production, every single step of the process involves an expenditure of energy. When energy becomes more expensive, there's a layering effect. And so if we're going to help to fight inflation and hammer down those costs for not just for employers but for consumers, we need to unleash Pennsylvania energy production.
And the voters themselves are going to have, I think, an especially strong voice in determining the outcome of these elections on a level that you don't normally see when it's a one against one primary type scenario. But the primaries coming up on May 17th, you know, in some cases feature 10 candidates.
It's like a softball team. Yeah.
Wow.
Seven candidates. And so the percentages by which candidates may win, it's probably not going to be a 60-40 kind of a thing. It's probably going to be someone could win the nomination for these statewide offices or a U.S. Senate seat with a small plurality,
30%,
21%, 25%, something like that can happen, which really means that every voter's vote counts much more than it normally would in determining the outcome.
Which brings me back to the point that the listeners hear me say over and over and over again. It is your job to exercise your citizenship, to live your life with your brain turned on, to know what's going on, and that when you're faced in the voting booth with this long list of names, you need to do the research to understand who these people are, what their credentials are, what their platforms are, and you've got to make the call of whether to trust them with the powers of these offices that belong to you, the people, through your Constitution.
Historically, looking at some of the Pennsylvania elections of the past where there have been numerous candidates like this, I think in 2010 there were maybe, I think, 10 candidates running for lieutenant governor. And if you look at the map of how those votes broke down, it was almost exclusively driven by geography.
Mm-hmm.
So each candidate was drawing in a large base of support from the area in which they lived. I think what was happening is voters were looking at, oh, this is the one closest to me geographically.
Right.
That's
right.
Not a good metric for determining who the best governor of Pennsylvania.
How we got Mike Stack.
The emphasis really has to be on the actual track record of these individuals that are running for office and their policies. We got to go beyond just looking at the simple geography of the matter and elect the very best candidates to square off in November.
Yeah, and obviously you can research candidates online. You can look at their websites. But there are so many candidates out there right now trying to get your votes and your signatures at this point. Seek them out. Find them. Find an event where they're speaking. Ask them questions. Like I said, I have a mental list of questions that I ask everyone who comes to my door to sign a petition, and really find out what the difference is between these candidates. Seek them out. Ask what they believe. It's really important this time around.
Watch PCN. You know, go to YouTube. Clearly, there are events where all of these candidates have spoken. That gives you a better sense of who they are, where they're coming from, and what they might do if entrusted with high office. I hope that we all, get through this process with some kind of I don't even know what the right word is. Dignity is probably too much to hope for, but clarity at least to get so that people have the chance to, as candidates, to put themselves before the voters, to make their case, and hopefully to get, you know, good people as the nominees to go before the voters in November.
And what we don't want to see is another situation in which the courts become embroiled in determining the results of the election. And, you know, we saw that in 2020.
Mm-hmm.
We've seen it as you mentioned, David, in the making of the new legislative maps, surrounded by litigation. I think we have to expect that there will be an effort by certain folks involved in the political arena to also try to determine the outcome of these elections by judicial action rather than votes.
Yeah, and not just the counting of the votes, but also the manner in which the election itself is conducted. Mm-hmm. And that's the political interference by the courts
the
in 2020.
The inconsistency between how it's administered from county to county, for example.
Yes, precisely.
I think that's all the more reason that folks got to just make sure they get out and vote, because the closer the election, the higher the likelihood that there will be challenges. So because there's few little votes that matter. So the broader the victory for the victor, the safer we'll be from any sort of challenge in those ways.
Yes. An unambiguous victory would help to, build public confidence in the result. But again, when things are close, that's when the rule of law is most important, and it's most important for it to be applied, rigorously and without favor. To say, look, that this is what the rules are, and when it comes down to somebody winning by one vote, this is how it's supposed to go. So, anyway, it's going to be a long and interesting journey between now and the May primary and the November election, and I'm just glad that I get to go on that journey with you folks.
Hold on tight.
Yes. So. Let's just wrap things up. Steve, where can the listeners go to find out more about you and your organization and the things that you do?
They can visit commonwealthfoundation.org.
Outstanding. Rebecca, where can people track you down?
They can find the Pennsylvania Motor Truck Association at pmta.org.
Outstanding. And as ever, you can find me online at pamanufacturers.org and on the Pennsylvania Cable Network on Sunday mornings at 8:30 with PMA Perspective. So from Steve and Rebecca and me, thanks very much for listening, and we will catch you next time on Capital Watch. And now, a town hall commentary from Loman Henry.
Thank you, David. As our forefathers labored in Philadelphia to draft what would become the enduring Constitution of the United States, they were careful to not only divide power among three branches of government, but to also create a national legislature of two chambers with the specific intent of having the U.S. Senate being the cooling saucer to, as James Madison said, provide a necessary fence against passions. Events of the past few months have indeed proved the wisdom of the framers in creating a federal government which, while at times is frustratingly slow, also does not act hastily and foolishly in reaction to transitory events. A perfect example is the set of cross-currents created by skyrocketing fuel prices and the parallel need to invest in the nation's infrastructure. The two are tied together as gasoline taxes, both federal and state, are a significant source of funding for the maintenance and improvement of our roads and bridges. Last month, when the Fern Hollow Bridge in Pittsburgh collapsed into the valley below, the need to invest more money in infrastructure dominated the national agenda. Congress, in a rare burst of bipartisan support, passed a gigantic so-called infrastructure bill that directed most of the new spending to the left's radical environmental agenda, but did indeed provide significant dollars for traditional infrastructure. Fast forward a few weeks, and the federal government's two-year spending orgy has triggered hyperinflation, with prices for staples such as groceries and gasoline rising exponentially. Gasoline, along with natural gas and home heating oil, are commodities that are especially sensitive areas for consumers. Seeking a scapegoat, the Biden administration is attempting to blame the spike in gasoline costs on the Russian invasion of Ukraine. The facts are domestic oil and gas production were dramatically reduced in 2020 and 2021 due to a drop in demand for folks sheltering in place during the COVID-19 pandemic. But as demand has returned to normal, production has not. This is because the Biden administration has waged a war on fossil fuels to placate the environmental extremists in its electoral coalition. The canceling of the Keystone XL pipeline, the ban on drilling on federal lands, the added regulatory hurdles, among other factors, have prevented expansion of the domestic supply. It is an incontrovertible law of economics that when demand exceeds supply, the price of the product will go up. So despite the fact the United States sits on more than enough gas and oil to be energy self-sufficient, government constraints on the industry have produced a shortage which triggered the rise in prices at the pump. The cost of gasoline and home heating products has become so high, consumer pressure is on elected officials to do something. This has given rise to calls at both the state and national levels to reduce or temporarily suspend gasoline taxes. Tax cuts are generally a good thing, but such action here would be akin to treating the symptoms rather than the disease. So let's connect the dots. A few weeks ago, a cry went up to spend more money on roads and bridges. Now the rhetoric focuses on suspending gas taxes, the very set of taxes that fund infrastructure maintenance. These contradictory demands are precisely the type of passions our forefathers warned against. Ulrich Boesen, senior policy analyst at the Tax Foundation, points out that the 18.4 cents per gallon federal gasoline tax, quote, contributes the majority of money to federal highway funding of roads and bridges. If you take that away for any period, you end up having to backfill that money with more deficit spending. More deficit spending, he concluded, will increase inflationary pressures. In other words, a suspension of the federal gasoline tax would make the currently historically high inflation rate even higher. Pennsylvania currently levies the highest gasoline tax in the nation at 58.7 cents per gallon. That tax provides funds not only for road and bridge maintenance and repair, but also for a variety of state and local municipal needs. A reduction or suspension of the state's gasoline tax would, as it would at the federal level, require a backfill in revenue from some other source or a temporary reduction in infrastructure spending. It would appear growing demands for more infrastructure spending and lower fuel taxes are at cross purposes. But there is a more realistic and effective solution: address the root causes of the problem. It is time for government at all levels to take its boot off the throat of the fossil fuel industry and allow the free market to dictate the development of our natural resources. By allowing demand rather than ideologically driven policies to dictate supply, we can lower fuel costs while also addressing our infrastructure needs. With a Town Hall commentary, I'm Loman Henry. If you miss hearing Lincoln Radio Journal on your favorite radio station, audio of our complete program is available on our websites, LincolnRadioJournal.com and LincolnInstitute.org. Hey, the 2022 Pennsylvania Leadership Conference is now less than 2 weeks away. The premier annual grassroots conservative event will be held April 1st and 2nd at the Penn Harris Hotel in Camp Hill. This year's featured speaker will be Fox News host, former Congressman Trey Gowdy. Former Kentucky Governor Matt Bevin will be the kickoff speaker. The conference will include forums spotlighting candidates for governor of Pennsylvania and for U.S. Senator. An added feature this year, a pre-conference election integrity summit to be held on Thursday, March 31st. As always, there will be speakers, panel presentations, and workshops. Complete information and registration for the 2022 Pennsylvania Leadership Conference is available at paleadershipconference.org. The Lincoln Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations. They include the Pennsylvania Manufacturers Association, the Houston Foundation of Coatesville, and the Allegheny Foundation of Pittsburgh, all of whom have helped to underwrite the costs of this program. Lincoln Radio Journal is a trademark of the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. From the Lincoln Broadcast Center in Harrisburg, I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to Pennsylvania's most widely broadcast public affairs radio program, Lincoln Radio Journal. Plug into the pulse of Pennsylvania.
Thank you.